pleasure to have with us this evening for our second Hebrew colloquium this fall, Dr. Gary Harlow. Dr. Harlow is a graduate of Cornell, a doctorate in some area of probability. I'm not sure the exact title of the degree. And he is doing work here at Biblical as a student, but he's also an assistant professor of mechanics at Lehigh University. And although it sounds like he's involved out there in putting nuts on the wheels of trailer trucks, in fact, it's all probability that he's doing, all high-flying mathematics. Dr. Harlow is going to speak to us tonight on is the origin of life a result of randomness? Dr. Harlow.
You're never supposed to start anything with disclaimers, but I'll do that. I have nothing against evolution as part of biology and chemistry, part as a science discipline per se, so I'm not going to make statements like evolution has never happened, will never happen, or is not happening. That's totally outside of my area of expertise. I would be fooling not very many people if I tried to discuss those things. What I'm interested in is the statement that people make regarding the origin of, let's say, molecules. There are many people, most of whom are doing things that are more philosophy, I think, than science, who will make statements like, molecules arose as a result of blind chance. You popular writers like Asimov and Sagan and some of those people make statements to that effect frequently. And the question is really what is meant by molecules or life arising as a result of blind chance. There's lots of different factors that come into play. First of all, when you're thinking in terms of technical probability, chance is sort of a vague word. And one of the major problems, I'll read a few quotes here in just a minute, but one of the major problems is that term is never well defined. What is meant by blind chance or randomness or things of that nature? So maybe just to set some of the background, I am only looking at very simple models, things. A lot of these things are certainly not new. And some of the people have said things like molecular evolution is almost on the same footing as the principle of indeterminacy of molecular physics. So there's that type of background, and again, I think that primarily that's not biology when people are talking like that. That's really philosophy or evolutionism or some term like that to describe it. It's interesting because you can look back and even Aristotle knew that unlimited chance can only produce chaos and not any order. So if you have chance that just runs rampant, whatever that means, you will never get order out of it to produce a protein that could then in turn produce life in some way. So the biologists, the evolutionists, have for a long time known. And on the one hand, while they'll say they want some kind of randomness, on the other, it can't be too great. Because if it's unlimited in some sense, you can never produce the kind of order that's required to reproduce proteins, etc., etc., if there's too much randomness. Now, there was a fellow, actually there was a convention down in Philadelphia, the Wistar Institute, on a thing, I think it was back in the late 60s, 67 I think it was, And there was a fellow there, yes, 67, there was a fellow there by the name of Eden, who actually was an electrical engineer, so he may not have known any more biology than I do, but basically what he was looking at, and he presented an argument, and I think if you look at the Wistar Institute comments, they had the paper, there was a respondent, and there was discussion time. From what I can tell, when he presented his argument, it was not really refuted very well. I don't think it's a very good argument, but it wasn't refuted very well, and it may have been lots of reasons for that. The major ones were maybe he just caught the biologists off guard, and they weren't prepared to really respond well. The other thing is when you begin to try and mix disciplines, it's very difficult to be able to make statements correctly on both sides of the issue. I've already admitted I'm not a biologist. I know almost nothing about the technical chemical evolution that's really involved. So if you ask me about processes, I'm going to tell you I don't know. So here I am coming as someone who claims they know something about probability, and yet nothing about the other side. So whatever conclusions or lack of conclusions that we draw are going to be based on a very limited perspective. That's the same thing in this situation, I think, except it was turned around. Eden was the speaker. He had the attack position, and the respondents were probably caught off guard. They were not thinking in terms of probability arguments. So as a result, basically, he said things like, take an example of a protein that consists of 250 amino acids. He claimed that there are 20 amino acids to the 250 ways that those amino acids could be arranged. And his contention is that there's only one of those that will give you the amino acid that you want, and the probability of picking the correct one is something like 1 × 10⁻³⁵. And then he went through an elaborate argument saying things like, if you consider a very generous age for the universe, I think he said something like 10 billion years old, and he went through and calculated all the things, somewhere I have estimates that at the origin stages or the early stages, they've estimated, this again is one of Sagan's numbers, so I'm not sure how accurate or how much the biologist or chemist would have agree with it. They claim there was something like 10 to the 44th amino acids floating around in the soup. So Eden went through and he made all of his calculations, and he claimed that the number of protein molecules that could have ever existed in 10 billion years was 10 to the 52. So when you compare that to roughly 10 to the 325, he stepped back and said, ha ha, see there, there's no way chance could have produced the right protein. Because look, out of all this time, 10 billion years, we could have only had this many. If we just cycle through them all, that's all we could have gotten to, and yet the total possibility was 10 to the 325th. That's roughly 20 to the 250th power. Well, the problems or difficulties with that argument, we'll look at it a little more in detail with some other numbers, but he's basically making two assumptions. One is independence. Independence, which means that if we have a chain here, and there's slots that have to be filled with amino acids, we're assuming a typical assumption is you take a populace where sequencing is essential. Then for any slot, there is no dependence on what the two neighbors were. So in other words, you just look at slot B and you say, whatever fits in there, fits in there. It doesn't matter what the two neighbors were or several neighbors are. It has nothing to do with that. They're all independent. So it's just a matter of picking the right amino acid and sticking it in the right sequence in the chain. Even with my limited background in chemistry and so forth, I think that's not a very good assumption at all. The second assumption that he made is what's known as equally likely, which means that any amino acid is just as likely to go in any slot as any other. There's where you have the 20. If we're assuming there's 20 amino acids, and for each slot on the chain, any one of the 20 could be stuck in there. Any one of the 20 could be stuck in there. So as a result, assuming those two assumptions, then you would have 10 to the 325th possibilities to consider. Now then, if you think about that a little bit, it doesn't take a genius to see that really what has to be addressed are these assumptions, are those assumptions. And indeed, the biologist, there you can look at papers where Eden's work is criticized, and basically they attack it by saying, this doesn't hold, and this probably doesn't hold. The second one is not as critical an assumption, I don't think, and it may be reasonably close to the truth because there does not seem to be too many amino acids that will function in a synonymous way. There are some people that have looked at them, and under certain classes of proteins, people have listed all of the synonymous type transactions you can make between amino acids. And there are not too many of them. So this assumption is not too bad, but it's not right. This one, the one of independence, is really the one that has to be discussed. And that's the one that the biologist started picking on. The difficulty is, as far as I'm concerned, I may repeat this more than once, but you have to understand that I'm primarily a mathematician who thinks that anything in the real world can be modeled by some mathematical model. It may be difficult to do that. It may be hard, it may be very complicated, but somewhere along the line, we have to be able to represent this physical process by some realistic mathematical model in order to really have a tangible thing that can be used to make predictions. You see, I'm in probability. I have no qualms at all about using randomness in all kinds of problems. I do it every day. But that doesn't bother me, but what does bother me is not having a model in which you can make predictions and assessing some probability that this class of predictions will come to pass. Well, after the biologist recognized this, I'll just read you one or two sort of representative quotes. A fellow by the name of Birch said, how can randomness or chance alone explain order? Of course, it cannot. You go on further to say that natural selection and no other process, even had that in quotes, turns chance into order. Natural selection and no other process turns chance into order. You see, the problem there, as far as I'm concerned, are really two things. One, we're still not clear what we're talking about in terms of chance. And you see, I'm a probabilist, And there are very clear and sharp ways to describe how probability events can occur. There are lots of different structures that you can generate that have a very crisp description. That's my background, and when we say chance, I don't know what is being intended there. But the thing that makes me even more unsettled is the term natural selection. To me, again, looking at this from a limited perspective, there is no description of how natural selection can be modeled. It's just sort of stuck in there when you need it. And I have looked, I'm not saying that no one has done it, but I have looked through a couple of reasonably good libraries like Cornell and Pennsylvania, and I cannot find the right sequencing of articles or books that begin to address in any situation how you mathematically describe the process of natural selection. So you see the argument that goes, here we've got the right chemical elements with the right energy and all the other right conditions, and then all of a sudden, we're in this random mess, and all of a sudden, zap, here comes natural selection, and the right protein comes into existence. I'm not saying that that's wrong, but what I am saying is I want to see what that magic natural selection does in terms of making my model. I can't find that. So, again, that may be more of the philosophical side of it. So the question is, and what really I want to do is to just generate several types of situations where you can introduce a random model. Now, we will eventually get back to what Eden started, but I want to start by playing some games here. Actually, these things are not new by me. They're very old. In fact, this first one's called the secretary problem. It's a classical problem. In fact, I'll tell you the parlor game version of it, so the next time you're at church and you want to get some little kid who's been needling you for a month or two and been asking this problem. Here's the problem. Secretary typed in letters. She's not very gifted in terms of organization, so she sits down and she types all the in letters. Then she realizes that she has to have the same number of envelopes addressed to the right people. So here she goes back through and she types out all the envelopes. Then some hurricane or something blows in through the window. Everything gets all scattered all over the place. She just starts randomly shoving letters into envelopes. Question, what's the probability that she gets a certain number right? We'll ask the question. What's the probability that she gets none right? Let's see. Okay. What does that have to do with our situation with amino acids? What I'm going to assume is that there are N slots or sites in the chain. I'm going to restrict things greatly. I'm going to say that there are N amino acids. So I have some protein that I want to do something. I know what I want it to do, and I know how to make the protein. I know the N slots, and I know where they're supposed to go. And furthermore, in my bucket here, I've got the right amino acids. Now what's the randomness? All I'm going to do is just randomly pick out of the bucket and throw them into the slots. So I've got N amino acids, and I'm going to put into N slots. That's all. So you see that totally has nothing to do with anybody's conception of what the primordial soup was like. because the assumption there was that we had N slots, yes, but we had almost an infinite number of amino acids of each type to throw in there. So this is greatly restricted. What this would have to say is, in the soup, not only did you have the N slots, but somehow there had to be a mechanism that abstracted the right N acids and put those in a little holding tank where you could just pick from those. Well, that's not a very good assumption, but at least for the sake of argument, let's look at it. Now then, what is here? Actually, this does have some connection with the sheet I handed out. We're trying to keep everything consistent. Let's let M equal the number of matches. Now, what do you want? Obviously, to make my protein work the way I want it to, I want all N slots in the chain to match properly and correctly with all N of the amino acids. So let Pm equal the probability of the M matches. All right, now then, on that sheet that I gave you, you have these three columns. Well, three sets of two. N equal 20, N equal 10, N equal 5. That corresponds to this N. M, which goes down the chart over here on the left, is the number of matches. It turns out, playing this game, that Pm is essentially e to the minus 1 over n factorial. N factorial is m times n minus 1 and n minus 2 times dot 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 2 minus 1 all the way down. So if m's reasonably large, then that's essentially what it is. You see here I've got that thing computed down the page. And for n equal 20, Pm, there's the corresponding number. You see that essentially they're the same all the way down. So what do you mean for large n? Well, you only need roughly 20. Only 20. So what's the answer to the secretary problem? If you were to say, suppose you've got 20 letters and 20 envelopes, what's the probability that you get none of them right? The answer is 0.367, etc., etc. Now then, okay. Now then, what do we do? You look there. Again, what you want is to have every one of them exactly right. And even with this very specialized problem where you have very few things to pick from, you see that for 20 amino acids in the right sequence, that probability is 4 times 10 to the minus 19, which again is extremely small, just for 20. And all of those numbers are pretty small. What is interesting, though, is that the expected number, or the average number, of matches, 1. Regardless of N. On the average, if you play this game, the expected number of matches that you get is just 1. Just 1 out of the whole chain. The standard deviation is 1. And in fact, I did some calculations here. If you go out for the n equal 20 case, if you go out 2 standard deviations, sort of a typical thing to do, you have over 98% of all of the possibilities. So what that means is that the lower tail, where the total perfect match would occur is very, very thin in this game. Okay, so we all agree that's not a very good game. It doesn't address reality very well. By the way, if you have questions, feel free to interrupt at any time. My students don't even bother to raise their hand. They just yell, so I'm used to anything. What's another game? Okay, we don't like that one. Let's try one that may be a little better. Let's suppose that we have the end sight. The end sight. And now, instead of having just N amino acids, we have N copies of the N amino acids. So now I've got a lot more in the pot. Instead of having just N, just the right N, I've got N copies of those N things. So you would think that the probability would go down. And we'll, for this case, we'll let BM, I think, is what I called it. Yeah. Equal the probability of N matches. And again, you see on your chart those probabilities. And indeed, they're smaller, although they're not that much smaller. If you want to get every one exactly right, that bottom number there is roughly 10 to the minus 27 compared to 10 to the minus 19. So it's smaller, but it's really not that much smaller. For this case, what do you have? You have N sites. I have N copies of the N amino acids. So at least we're beginning to get closer to what the primordial soup would be like. I'm not claiming that that's what it is. It's just more representative. What do we have? Average number. What do you think? One. Again. Just one. Standard deviation now is 1 minus 1 over n. So it's roughly the same thing that we had over there. If n is not too big, it's smaller. The larger n gets, of course, the closer we get to that case. So even in this case, where you would think that the probability would be much smaller, you're still only expecting to get one match. And again, the amount of the probability under just a few standard deviations puts you into the lower tails very quickly. Okay.
Yes.
Sometimes some of these things are under zero.
Oh, yes, right. That's always a question. You see on the chart there, the next to the last one under the PM is zero. Remember, that's the matching problem. If you look at the N equal 5 case, there's no way you can have just 4 matches if you've got 5 envelopes. Because if you get 4 right, there's only one letter and one envelope left, and it has to match. So that's a result. I mean, that's a consequence of having only N exact slots. You cannot have N minus 1 matches without having them all. Yeah. You know, they're good questions for students. They never get that under the heat of battle. So, yeah. Now then, I want to play one more game here. And then go to a different type of thing. Now this third game, so there's one, two, here's the third one. I've got N sites. This time, I've only got one type of amino acid. Just one. I'm going to stick that one in every single site. Now, obviously, that's wrong. That's wrong, obviously. What's the expected number, or the average number? that you're going to get right. One. Somewhere along there, I'm going to get the one right that it's supposed to be. All the rest of them are wrong. All the rest of them are wrong. What's the standard deviation here? Standard deviation here is zero. You only get one right, and you get that one right, and everything else is wrong. So there's no variation at all. It's a deterministic problem, so therefore the standard deviation is zero. It's a deterministic problem. Now, what does this have to do with anything? I'm not sure. But at least, you see that if you take three apparently different mechanisms, and maybe none of them have anything to do with reality, I can't really judge on that score. But in this case, you would think you would have a reasonably nice situation. Here we're talking laboratory experiment, where you've got everything set up just the way you want it, and you want to make it work. The probabilities are very low. The expected number of correct matches is only one. Here in a more general setting, where you don't have all of the nice structure because you've really got too many amino acids to pick from, the probabilities are lower. The expected number of correct matches is only one. Over here, when you play a dumb game, it makes no sense at all physically. The number of matches is one and only one. So at least what you can say is that even in this reasonable spectrum, the probability of getting perfect matches is very small, and in fact, the number that you expect to get is very small. So, what's the conclusion? Does that prove that life didn't arise by chance? No, I'm not sure it has anything to do with it at all, except to point out that you can have a large spectrum of models that can give you almost the same type of results, so that one has to be very careful in the way they want to describe their process in order to be able to make conclusions, especially conclusive conclusions. The other thing is, if we want to insist that there's still randomness involved in these chains. You see all these numbers I gave you, there's only 20 in the chain. Blood, I think, averages around 140, 145, something like that in the chain. If you want to come back to reality and say there must be chance in there, I force it to be in there, or it is in there, then at least you're going to have to do a better job than this kind of modeling, because it won't give you order out of that kind of randomness. All right, now then. Maybe I should stop here for a second and ask, are there any questions? Next thing I want to discuss is almost an entirely new phase. Yeah.
You said you checked the libraries that put on a pen concerning models for natural selection equation or something.
Yeah.
You talked about biology.
Oh, yeah.
What did
they say? Well, I have not found any. You see, again, I tried to mention it earlier. Most biologists hate math. Most biologists, even at the PhD level, are rare if they've had more than a calculus sequence. They've had very little exposure to real model building from a mathematical standpoint, and they've even had less exposure to probability and probability modeling. So you just don't run down to the dime store and ask your biologist friend what to do here.
Well, you see, here again you're beginning to ask philosophical questions. And I would think that if you want to discuss philosophy of biology and those evolutionism type things, the answer should be yes. Compelling for me to have some better presentation. But you see, in reality, I would say that maybe 99.9% of all the biologists and chemists and other scientists in the world don't think about this. When they go to work in the morning, they've got a job to do, and it really has nothing to do with philosophy. They're just doing their job. So from that sense, it's not compelling.
I'm pretty ignorant of all these things, but in their literature, they're being attacked along these lines, and they're saying that their arguments are really not good arguments because they're naive in this way. Wouldn't somebody try to demonstrate that they're not naive?
Yeah, but you see, now you're getting at the other side of the coin. You see, the people who are attacking them are creationists. Those are the villains, whichever side you're on. There's the evolutionist versus the creationist, and we do mortal battle almost every day. Most evolutionists read things that are put out by creation scientists in the spirit of the Henry Morris and all of that school. This is my philosophy. If you want to strike it from the tape, feel free to, but in my opinion, they are doing such lousy science that they have no credibility with real, honest-to-goodness biologists. So when you have Henry Morris making the statement, let me tell you what happened in the formative stages of the Earth, and we know that the Earth has only been around for a few thousand years, 10 to 20, whatever they pick, then most people who are real scientists trying to grapple with geological, astrological, biological evidence, just going to say, he's a quirk. I don't care what he has to say from now on. So you see, and you can find quotes. Dave Bossert brought in a collection of quotes that he's been putting on his word processor, where you have biologists saying that those people just are not true to science at all. And if they're not true to science, then why listen to them? Now then, the biologists aren't being fair because they haven't listened to me, but or someone who holds a mediating position, but then maybe we haven't presented a viable mediating position well enough for them to listen to. So you see, there's lots of issues and tensions here. Most places, if you were to suggest that evolution has been demonstrated at least on certain levels in the Christian community, you'd be lucky to get out with your head. And yet you see, before you can even address an unbelieving biologist, you have to be able to say, yes, I understand your position, and this is my understanding of science that's compatible with what he can clearly demonstrate. I think these people who make philosophical statements, if you pin them down, they'd say, sure, that's my philosophy. I think they could distinguish when they're doing science and when they're doing philosophy. And I think what the apologetic task is to show that their philosophy is not sound. Because they're good scientists. They're not going to show that their science is bad. I mean, they've got real professionals at their throat to show that their science is not good. It's a vicious world amongst those people. Ask Gould, who came out with his punctuated equilibrium theory. I guarantee you he's had the wolves at his door for a long time trying to show that impossibility. And they've been fighting amongst themselves. So anyway, anything else? Yeah.
You know, as the suits that were produced in the laboratory under laboratory conditions, and I was wondering if probability theory addresses that particular fact and so in what way?
I'm not exactly sure what your question is again now. Rephrase it. I know, like the Miller experiment and things of that nature. So,
What's the question now?
The question is, I was wondering if there is anything in probability theory to explain the fact that under laboratory conditions, amino acid chains can be produced.
Okay.
Yeah. I think I understand your question. Let me, that actually is a nice question to lead into what I want to discuss a little bit. Let me answer that now from a slightly different approach, although it's related to probability theory. It's called information theory. There's a fellow, I have to admit that I have not done a sufficient amount of work with his material. There's a fellow by the name of Hubert P. Yockey, Y-O-C-K-E-Y. Anybody heard of him? Have you read his stuff? What do you think of it?
I don't know nothing about it.
This Yockey fellow is, let's see, where's his call number? Army Pulse Radiation Facility, Aberdeen Proving Ground, Maryland. So I'm assuming that he's got a responsible job, and he's doing a responsible job. I know that I have 1, 2, 3, 4, about 5 papers that he's written. A lot of them start with stuff like the information content of cytochrome C. And he discusses some of these aspects of how amino acids are transferable or synonymous and all those things. He says, in fact, amino acid residues are not, in general, synonymous. So we go through a lot of technical reports that I cannot read from the biological standpoint. And then he gets into doing things on information, which is based on probability arguments. Now, in his first attempt was to try and measure the amount of information required to produce some protein out of amino acids. He claims that biologically you could do the same thing if you had the next step up. You're looking at other types of things that I'm not sure about. But what he does his calculations with are amino acids and proteins. Let me, here's his conclusion. Taking into account only the effect, of this mixture that he's talking about, the longest chain which could be expected with 95% confidence in 10 to the 9th years corresponds to only 49 amino acid residues. This is much too short to code a living system, so evolution to form higher forms could not get started. Geological evidence for the, quote, warm little pond, end quote, is missing. It is concluded that belief in currently accepted scenarios of spontaneous biogenesis is based on faith contrary to conventional wisdom. So that's in his abstract. On one of his early articles, where he goes through and does the calculations, I don't think it would be too critical to look at them, but he goes through and he shows that most chains there just isn't enough information available. Now then, in his paper, he again, and that one anyway, he's doing independent. You see, that starts out at the place where Eden started out, and that's where we're back to discussing whether or not that's a viable assumption. Which, again, I don't think it is. In a later paper, he comes out with, again, his big final statement in his abstract is that it is concluded that, in italics, at present, there are no scientifically valid origin of life scenarios. Consequently, belief in little green men in outer space is purely religious, not scientific. That's in his abstract. And the thing that's interesting to me is this is in the Journal of Theoretical Biology. I would assume that that's a pretty good journal, but again, I can't judge. In this paper, what he looks at is not the independent case, but a dependent case. A dependent case, which is contained in what's known as Markov chain theory. Now then, at least what Markov chain theory does is when you're looking at the sites, let's say we make them boxes here. Let's say this is the I box and it has amino acid I in it. What a Markov chain theory would do is compute probabilities like Pij. That would be the probability of having amino acid I, or J rather, added or inserted to a chain given that amino acid I was last, or something like that. But what that would say is you're traveling along. Let's assume we're adding them from the end. I get to this slot here. I know which amino acid's there. I know what it is. And given that this particular one is there, what's the probability that I can put J there? So you see, now you're beginning to really build some kind of structure into things, which to me seems more reasonable. You see, if you do these experiments where you've got all the right conditions, you've got the right kind of suits, you've got the right kind of energy, you've got everything there, some of these amino acids are chemically more attracted to others than others. The bonding. Some bonds are stronger, some are weaker. And based on the conditions of how they begin to bond, there is certain amino acids that are favored over others. I think in a crude way, that's why these laboratory experiments work. So in order to really look at it, what you need to know is that given what's here, or given the conditions, what's the probability that I can insert one? Now you see, that eliminates, number one, the independence. That eliminates the equally likely. All in one fell swoop. Well, he addresses that issue in his second paper. What's his assumption? His assumption is, it N is still the number of slots in the chain. Then the number that he's interested in here is 4.153 times N. That's the number of possibilities that you would have in the independent case. So you work this thing out, let's say you have 100 amino acids in your chain, multiply 4.153 times 100, brings 2 to that power, that tells you the number of possible chains. Alright, now he works out the same thing with the Markov chain case. Markov chain case. He gets 2 to the 4.153 times N. And he says that for this reason, he's given some argument here, for all practical reasons, that's the same thing.
And you see what that says in terms of information or in terms of probability, what that's saying is, even though I've introduced this dependence, it's not given me anything. Now, he's got some argument here. If you've read this, I'll let you look at it again and you can tell me what you think about it. To me, I don't see how it can possibly be right. Markov chains are not the most strongly dependent probability processes, but they're not weakly dependent either. And to say that, in effect, having a Markov chain structure really doesn't reduce the probability just does not seem right. I have not been able to really assess that in any great detail.
In fact, one of the interesting things about Markov chains is that the repetition of the Markov chain experiment will tend to lead to a limiting distribution.
Yeah,
and you might even make that into an interesting case, saying that there might be a tendency to head toward certain stable states or something like that.
Yeah, you see, if you have these probabilities and you raise that to the power,
stay with the same notation,
capital N. So what I'm doing is I'm building a longer and longer chain, so I've got more and more amino acids. The thing, under the right suitable assumptions, and if we've only got 20, amino acids, you'd have a 20 by 20, matrix to consider, because given any amino acid, you want to know what's the probability of going to another one. So you're most talking about a 20 by 20 structure that's finite. That gives you, because it's finite, that gives you all the right type of assumptions you need for the theoretical aspect. This thing converges to a value pi. Well, this is the probability itself. It's the number between 0 and 1.
Ij as n goes to infinity.
You see, that's what has me bothered, because on the one hand, he's claiming that there's no difference at all. And yet on the other hand, under the right kind of conditions, this thing's very stable. It converges to some limit. Another thing is, you see, the summation of these pi j's and add to 1. So it's not like all of these things are nearly zero. Most of them may be nearly zero, but some of them have to be large enough so that the sum is 1. And I have been puzzling over that for a little while, and I'm not exactly sure that what he's done is correct. Now then, let's assume, so now we're in the rule session time, nothing more than that. Let's assume that a Markov chain type approach is really the right thing. That's really what the biologists want. And that would really turn out to explain what he wants. Number one, I can't believe that nobody else has thought of that, because Markov chain theory is one of the first things you learn. Number two, even if no one has thought about it, and I'm on the verge of a Nobel Prize, I'll let you come to my award if you want to. If I'm on the verge of that prize, then what I have to have is I have to have the biologist tell me what these numbers are here. And that's a very difficult task. That's the hard part, being able to set up the real structure. See, you can do all kinds of different things with different letters. But the hard thing is to describe these numbers. That's going to be impossible, because we don't really know what the soup was like way back when. So
So even under laboratory conditions, those would be just crude approximations, if that. So, back to the original question, yes, there are ways to build models that have dependence in them. Yes, there are. And yes, you can build a model that you can have a reasonable amount of structure if everything falls together in the right way. What's the problem? Well, you have to describe the basis of the model, which means doing, making assumptions or looking at the conditions from experiments or something like that. And secondly, there still has to be some description of what this natural selection means. Is this right or not? You see, no one, again, has characterized it. Is that really what natural selection means at that stage? I don't know. So there's still a lot of things that biologists have not either come to grips with or been able to address. And that's sort of where the state of affairs is. So the question, was randomness responsible for the origin of molecules? I think in terms of the conclusion, the answer is we don't know. I think there are so many unknown things that really, to either say yes or no at this point, based on science, is very tentative, because too many things that aren't known, and most of the discussion of this really falls in the realm of philosophy rather than science anyway. So that's sort of a vague, unpleasant conclusion and way to end, but that's basically where it is as far as I can determine.
It seems to me that the amino acid question, the forming of amino acids by random processes, is simple enough that you could probably get a handle on it. But the thing is there, what you have to ask yourself is, well, we know a little bit about hydrogen and oxygen, we know a combination of things and carbon. What kind of model would you come up with? And you certainly wouldn't come up with an independent model.
Because you have a tendency to put a water molecule on something or whatever, you know, whatever is the proper mechanism. I don't know much about chemistry myself. But it almost certainly wouldn't be an independent model.
I think the Markov chain model sounds very interesting.
What that would be saying, in effect, the Markov chain model would effectively be saying that the proteins we have are limiting distribution, in a sense, are the result of are kind of a stable limiting distribution of the process. And that's a very intriguing thought.
The problem, the only thing. The problem is, if these things aren't picturized, what I'm afraid would happen is that all the pi j's, out of the 20 pi j's here, or whatever we do to build it, most of them are insignificant, and there's only two or three that have any real sizable probability, which would say that the tendency is for your chain to form all just one type of amino acid, or maybe two or three.
Yeah, well, see, the thing there is that
protein formation, I guess you would say,
really is not just a matter of adding an amino acid to the end of the chain. You really got a three-dimensional structure there.
That's true.
Going for.
Oh, yeah.
So your dimension is not just 20-dimensional, you know, if this is this certain kind of amino acid, what's the probability of reaching the 20 other ones?
Oh, yeah, sure.
You really have a very complex structure to the state space that is much more higher dimension than 20, and probably hundreds of thousands, maybe, I don't know. But it's an
intriguing possibility, which I personally have not thought very much about, thinking of the proteins that you study take after the Markov chain model. This is kind of an intriguing thought.
Well, you see, to me, you really don't have any other kind of stochastic process that's manageable that has much dependence in it. If you talk about any of the other stochastic processes, they really are pretty hard to deal with. And
yeah, well, see, there's another, one of the models for formation of the early molecules that I've seen was sort of a sticky model, which says that there's a tendency for certain types of proteins to amino acids to combine, and then so you've got these little primitive partial chains that are combining and moving around, and then they tend to combine in certain ways, and so you start out with pairings, and then quadruplings, and then tuplings, and so forth and so on, and that's the way you grow them up, rather than talking about proteins at one at a time, it's sort of like that.
Yeah.
All primitives come on the X parts of things.
Yeah, see this Yaki guy says that doesn't make any difference.
I don't believe that.
He says that's in terms of his information argument.
I might believe it's a result of his intention
to
follow
the
goal, but I don't
think it really doesn't make any difference. Well, I mean, he's talking about in the tail so far that, which again, I'm not sure he can substantiate that. I can't understand the biology enough to know whether his arguments are valid on those points. Yeah.
But in protein, there's almost no constraints that one amino acid should follow another one. In any sequence of a protein, there's no apparent probability at least that one amino acid should follow another one.
Which means basically the probabilities are all the same order of magnitude.
Reverse the Markov chain theory, that essentially for an independent model, the probabilities are either equal or very small.
Proved, then you're back into the realm of more the independent type structure.
Actually, the second assumption, I think, has more in it than just from the chemistry of amino acids, the independence, I don't know how you can really deal with the independence because the activity or reactivity is not that much different. But what was the second assumption?
Equally likely?
Equally likely is, I think, more improbable in a sense than the independence idea of being improbable. Because the abundance of amino acids varies. So it's much more likely that one will win a slot on another one from these funds developed in funding.
So what you're saying is that the reason why does an amino acid go into a slot? Is it because of the other surrounding amino acids? You said no. It's just a matter of there being so much more of.
As you're dealing with a random situation, it becomes a stoichiometry problem. And if something is there 100 times more abundantly than another one, it's more 100 times more likely to go into a slot.
The model would basically be to be independence in slots, but with an infinite number of things go in the slots, but proportioned by the frequency of them, that they have relative proportions. So you give them a fraction between 0 and 1 for each of the proportions, and then ask what the probability of constructing a particular chain.
But all the amino acids in the protein are not given the same amount. Large amount and others are small amount. And it turns out the more complex, structurally complex amino acids are present at much lesser abundances in the protein than the more simple ones. And you would expect in some type of a random chemical or mixture or some situation that would synthesize amino acids in a random way, the simple ones would outnumber the more complex. So in that sense, I think the likelihood of that things are equally likely, I think, seems to me more improbable than the independent assumption.
The difficulty is if you have independence, even with varying probabilities, so that you have the unequally likely case, the independence is such a strong assumption, that's going to drive the probabilities down very rapidly. And the only way you can keep probability up is to make it conditional on something.
You know, that's an important factor. I think it may be, in fact, looking at this, that one's going about it in the wrong way. Proteins are not made simply by mixing amino acids together and having them react. Perhaps it should be approached from the side of the nucleic acids, which instead of 20, you have 4 different components in the nucleic acids.
Then the problem becomes how
to translate whatever information you may have in the sequence of the nucleic acid into the protein. There has to be some interfacing type of mechanism.
Put back into the thing, doesn't it? Because the nucleic acids with only 4 letters, so to speak, have to have much longer words in the protein in order to give them a comparable word in 20 letters. And most of me like probabilities will come back saying that there's magnitude. You can make a few.
I can make a statement about the unequal probabilities, and that is that the example wants to work out that the highest probability is for unequal probabilities. And if you have unequal, it's just a lower probability. You can even see that take that 0.5, 0.5 times 0.5 is 0.25. Or say 0.2 times 0.8 is 0.16, okay?
And if you take anything, and you take any number between 0 and 1 and multiply them together, you get the higher probability in your eyes and get it all in. So that's the extent the most conservative consequence of people. And you help just get lower.
Yeah. And the only way you can get higher than the independent, than the equally likely case, is to make it conditional in some way.
You have to have a high variability. So conditional, you want to restore information.
The question of the L amino acids versus the V amino acids is something that comes through. That if you make amino acids chemically, you get an equal mixture of both L and V stereoisomers. But biologically active proteins only have L isomers. And there must be some way of discriminating the L from the V, which in some raises your probability.
Now, and see, here's another aspect which I've tried to really stay away from. I know that once you have a sufficient protein and nucleic acid structure, that somehow or the other, which I'm not sure we can explain very well, but anyway, somehow or the other, you begin to get nice things to start to happen. That's even more outside of where I could possibly discuss. What I wanted to do is just talk about the very first building of these basic things.
And I mean, that's
basically all I wanted to look at in terms of the probability. I know that when you get into the more advanced stages, that people have demonstrated certain tendencies or favorable reactions over unfavorable things and so forth.
Another factor I wouldn't have the idea of how one could even evaluate it would be the role of catalysts. And any reaction like this would not fail at all without some type of catalyst. What these kinds of things would be, and these types situation than an idea. But it certainly would be a factor that in some scenario I think would have to be considered.
See, that's really, I mean, I'm very sympathetic because, you know, jokingly said, I mean, there's nothing I would like better than to be able to say, here's the model and explain it to the whole world. I could almost retire and sit back on my laurels if I could do that. So on the one hand, I would really like to do that. On the other, there are so many of these questions that you've raised and that I've seen raised elsewhere that really have no quantifiable answer. I don't know what to do with them. So what I object to then is still insisting from a philosophical point of view now that we do things just by chance or these things occur just by chance. In fact, I react to that just as strongly as every time that we can't explain how the chemical processes work, we say, well, God must have supernaturally intervened. I don't like that answer either. I would not think, I would not claim that I'm a theistic creationist. Or evolutionist or something like that, but I don't want to impose a God of the gaps any more than a natural selection little God of the gaps anytime that there's a difficult problem. And again, I agree that that's a philosophical issue rather than a science one. And again, we're back to the thing that we started with. Until there's some meeting of the minds in terms of some people who can do math modeling and some people who know enough biology and the two can communicate well, and they require more scientific insight, then we're still going to be in a mess.
The problem with the status at the moment is that three models have been proposed, the probabilities are astronomically small. The burden of proof is from someone who claims that they have formed this way.
They come up with a model that they're not astronomically small. And by astronomically small, I mean astronomically small in the volume and size of the universe and the length of time you could reach the universe.
Yeah. Not astronomically small for some pond in the tropics.
So,
I think you could put a little structure on at that point. And of course you could argue with the God of gas. But, if there is a God who intervenes in the nature, the places where you're likely to find him are the places where there is no physical procedure that will explain the phenomenon. Now, obviously, a person can say, well, we don't know there's none, we just haven't found him. It'll always be that way to life judgment. So we need to make some attempt to try and figure out how to judge the difference between, well, somebody's going to come up with one someday, and the chances of him will ever come up with one. I have some kind of gut feeling, that we're dealing with a situation that all the reasonable models so far show astronomically small probabilities. I intend to use that as an argument until somebody comes up with one that's only geologically small or something.
The models that you mentioned are, I think, very simple ones, which have turned out that way.
I think what you had mentioned earlier would be if someone would deliberately try to design something to make the probability very high, and see what would be the conditions under which something like that might occur, and do you have any reasonable basis to think that anything like this would have occurred? You know, someone to try to push it in.
Oh, I've been very interested to see such a model. I'm a little surprised there's not been such a model in the place. After all, the biologists are not the only evolutionists in the world.
No.
There must be an awful lot of mathematicians who are evolutionists.
Well, of course.
And they could win a Nobel Prize with a reasonable model. Where is it?
One of the most well-known, and a fellow that I've talked to on several occasions, is a fellow by the name of Sam Carlin. Whether you had enough math to run across his name or not. But for the past,
about 10 years now, he's been working on mathematical genetics. And he has tried to model natural selection in terms of the natural selection that goes on at the animal level, I think is the best way to describe it. Even there, his models are so crude, and there's two reasons for it. One, he has difficulty in trying to describe the natural selection on the level that he's working on, because, again, this thing, you just don't know how to describe it. The second thing is, if you make it too complicated, then you have trouble doing any mathematics at all. So there are some mathematicians who are doing mathematical biology, and I know, I mean, Sam Carlin wrote the book that everybody used for a long time on this basic introductory stuff. I know he knows that. And what I don't know is why Markov chains is not a viable option to pursue. And then, like Bob said, sure, all these models were all trumped up, but the biologists have not, or anybody for that matter, has not given any help in proposing any alternative. They just keep saying chance or randomness and so forth. That is too vague of a term to be allowed to stand without being questioned. That's really all that I wanted to really indicate. Yeah, anything else?
Okay, thank you very much.